The following message is by Dr. Jason DeRoshi, Research Professor of Old Testament and Biblical Theology at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary and Content Developer and Global Trainer with Hands to the Plow Ministries. You can find more from Dr. DeRoshi at www.jasonderoshi.com.
As we come to the singular book of Ezra Nehemiah, we've got two sections. Temple and city. It's where the focus is, and yet each part ends with a focus on the people associated with those spheres. So there seems to be a symbolic quality happening in the book that as you restore the physical temple, the call is to restore hearts that are willing to worship the elevated presence of God. As you restore, as you build walls around the city, the vision is to build walls around the human hearts of the people, to guard them from what is evil and not good. Now, someone had mentioned the Bible Project. If you're familiar with the Bible Project, it provides really helpful syntheses of the biblical books. In 8 to 10 minutes, you can capture, you know, the entire flow, and it's usually highly creative and helpful in certain respects. So from my perspective, one of the consistent challenges with the Bible Project is its minimization of sin and the holiness of God. That story after story, it fails to account significantly enough for the actual violations of mankind in relation to the holiness of God. And the need for Jesus is that it's grounded in true violation of God's holiness. But then I just take issue with certain elements, specifically here in the Ezra Nehemiah episode. They do think that Ezra and Nehemiah are portrayed as morally fraught mess-ups. And while I think the book is doing that, it seems to me the opposite, that we have two figures that are honoring of the Lord, but I could be wrong on that. I haven't written a commentary on Ezra and Nehemiah. But it seems to me that the narrator is wanting us to see Ezra as grounding his activity in the law of the Lord, and that the narrator is wanting us to see Nehemiah as bathed in the law of the Lord, and that is indeed what's guiding their practice, including the mass divorces. So we want to reflect on that. It's one of the ethical challenges of this book, and what would the lasting significance of that be for the Christian church? So rebuilding a broken temple in hope, rebuilding a broken city in hope. A handful of diagrams that were part of your textbook reading that I just want to draw attention to. Just to try to put flow of thought, Daniel was exiled in 605 BC, and it says that he lived until the first year of Cyrus, which would be 538. So Daniel has this extended ministry as a court official in Babylon first and then in Persia. Now in 538, remember, you got to think backwards with your calendar. Time is stretching. It's climbing behind Christ, and it's climbing out of Christ in both directions. So in 538, that's when Cyrus takes over as king of Persia. In 539, he makes the decree that Israel is allowed to return. So these are key events in Babylon and Persia, key events in Judah. So I just said that wrong. 539, he becomes king. 538, he makes the decree. So in 538, the first batch of returnees head to Jerusalem. The high priest is Joshua. The governor is Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel is of Davidic descent. He's in the line of Judah, and he plays a role in the books of Haggai and Zechariah, as we'll see next semester, plays a key role in being a type, a picture of the coming Messiah. The fact that he is in the Davidic line is used in both books to heighten hope for the ultimate king of David. When there's no king on the throne, the fact that there is still a Davidic descendant gives us hope in the coming king. But he's not only a king, he's a priest. And that's where Joshua comes in. He plays a role in providing a typological pointer to the coming single individual priest king. 70 years to the month from when Jerusalem was destroyed, the temple was rebuilt. And in 516, that temple is finalized. Who are the key prophets? Haggai and Zechariah. Now, it is this story, Cyrus's decree, through the rebuilding of the temple, that is recalled in the first half of Ezra. So it is because of that, I think, that our English Bibles have placed Ezra and Nehemiah before Esther. But what that misses is the fact that Ezra and Nehemiah is set up to be understood in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, and that the first six chapters are merely catching us up to know what was happening in Jerusalem, middle column, what was happening in Judah during the days since Daniel. So Daniel is all Babylon, and then Esther is in Babylon. And then the focus moves from Babylon to Jerusalem. But there was a first group, and the book of Ezra, Nehemiah, catches us up on that history of, okay, you just finished the story of Esther, but there was stuff going on during those days. So Esther is 486 to 463, roughly this 17-year period, and, or is that, try 23-year period, and the Book of Esther, sorry, the book of Ezra and Nehemiah opens with six chapters recalling what took place from Cyrus's decree all the way up through the days of Esther, but it's what's going on in Jerusalem during this window. Then we get Ezra's memoirs, and we find out that Ezra and Nehemiah, they were not complete overlapping figures. Nehemiah is likely younger, and Ezra takes off in 458 with a group of only about 5,000 Jews from Babylon, in contrast to the 50,000 that went during the first return. And so a small group are going back, and 50,000 people, even in the first return, is not very much. There's not a lot of Jews. Most of them have chosen, like Esther's family had, to stay in Babylon. To stay in Persia, that is, in around the sphere of the capital. And but Ezra is there, and then years later, nearly 15 years later, Nehemiah is going to show up, and Ezra is still going to be alive enough to help lead in a second reform movement during the days of Nehemiah. Malachi is dealing with the exact same issues that we read about in Ezra and Nehemiah, but Malachi never mentions Ezra, never mentions Nehemiah, nor does Ezra and Nehemiah ever mention Malachi. So it's a little bit tricky, even though it's very apparent that they're dealing with the exact same issues, it's tricky to know exactly how we're to line them up temporally. But what is clear is that the Jews talk about Malachi being the last of the prophets, which suggests that Malachi, if he did overlap with Ezra and Nehemiah, he likely outlived both of them. His ministry is in the days probably directly after Nehemiah, or he may have just not, the book may just not tell us that he was there during their time. But it's right around there, around 430 is when Malachi is ministering, and Nehemiah is around 444. So here's a comparison of these three returns. Now you remember the three returns actually match the three exiles. So in 605, Daniel and his friends were taken. Then in 597, Ezekiel was taken along with some other Jerusalem elite. And it's only in 586 that the rest of the Jews are exiled and Jerusalem is destroyed. So 605 and 8 years later, 597, and then 11 years later, 586. Nebuchadnezzar was the captain of the army in 605, and by 586, he's the king. Then we jump down, and we've got three returns. First is 538, and we read about that in Ezra 1, and it carries us to Ezra 6. Then in Ezra 7, we learn about the second return in 458 under that Ezra leads. So Artaxerxes the first is King Xerxes or Ahasuerus, the king of Esther's day. It's his son. So this is the very next generation. Esther's husband is dead. And the son, so Esther could have been the queen mother during these days. But Ezra is the priest. Joshua, the priest from the beginning of the story, is dead. Ezra is now the key priest. And Zerubbabel, the governor, is now replaced by Nehemiah, the governor. So key prophets, Haggai and Zechariah in the first return, potentially Malachi in the second return. And second and third returns. First return was about rebuilding the temple. Second return is the people of the temple, restoring worship accordingly. And then third return is rebuilding the city. You've got roughly 50,000 people in the first return. I said 5,000. It's actually less than that. Less than two, and we don't know of any other than Nehemiah and the soldiers that he took with him that went in the third return. But he's coming now as a new leader. So the temple began, sacrifices are instituted, Samaritans cause trouble, and the temple is completed. There's the challenge of interfaith marriage and communal confession, and then the temple and city wall are finally that is the wall of the temple, the wall of the city are completed, but they continue to battle numerous problems. So just a framework. Now let's just walk through this story as it's laid out for us, just noting a number of high points. Cyrus's decree. A number of you wrestled to understand how could the Cyrus cylinder declare Marduk as the chief god, and yet the biblical text says that Cyrus says Yahweh. We read in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, the word of Yahweh by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled. Yahweh stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia. No problem. He's in charge of all things. He raises kings. He lowers kings. He stirs up the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout the kingdom and also put it in writing. Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, Yahweh, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he's charged me to build a house for him at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of Yahweh, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem. And let each survivor in whatever place he sojourns be assisted by the men of his place with silver and gold, with goods and with beasts, besides the freewill offerings for the house of the God that is in Jerusalem. So what do we do? Having found the Cyrus cylinder, it's very clear, whereas Assyria and Babylon deported their prisoners of war, removed them from their places of origination. Persia has a completely different policy. Theirs is return the prisoners of war, and with them, all of their gods, allow them to reestablish their temples. That's how the Cyrus cylinder talks. And yet the Cyrus cylinder makes clear that Cyrus has adopted, ironically, the chief god of the Babylonians. He just defeated the Babylonians, yet he says, your god is still in charge. It's very ironic. So he adopts the chief god of the Babylonians, and Marduk is the key figure that he is declaring has commissioned him to send back not only the peoples, but according to the Cyrus cylinder, all of their gods back to the places where they came from, in the hope that, and this is how the Cyrus cylinder talks, in the hope that all of these gods and with them their peoples might honor Marduk above all things, and with Marduk honor Cyrus. So he's hoping that in taking a different matter, a different approach with prisoners of war, he'll have a happier empire. So I'll let you go back, you can worship your God, and in the process, stay loyal to me. When we read this text, though, it reads as if Yahweh's in charge of all things and Cyrus knows it. I don't see evidence, in contrast, like we did with Nebuchadnezzar, where I proposed it's very possible in my mind that Nebuchadnezzar is going to be in glory with us. That the awakening that we see, this progression through those first four chapters of Daniel, is a move from recognition that your God is strong to a recognition that your God is alone God. And I don't necessarily see that with Cyrus. I don't see this as a testimony necessarily, having read a fair amount of ancient Near Eastern propaganda. That's what this feels like to me, that you have a king who's wanting to tickle the ears of the people, and yet little does he know, just like Caiaphas, declaring that Jesus would not only die for his own people, but for many others scattered abroad, John chapter 11. Similarly, that Cyrus, in declaring in an ear-tickling way, Yahweh has granted favor and commissioned me to send you back to Jerusalem, I think it shows up in this book. It may have been, those may very likely have been the very words that he used. And yet, the narrator snags them and uses them to testify to the absolute truth. Yahweh was in charge of it all, and he is the God of heaven, and he is the one orchestrating all of these events. So it sounds to me like ear-tickling propaganda that is the same thing that guided the construction that we read about in the Cyrus cylinder. Why is it that he's letting all these people go back in order that they might honor him and honor Marduk, but it doesn't get around the fact that it says Yahweh, the God of heaven. It could be that that is how the Jews always referred to their God. He is Yahweh, the God of heaven. Yahweh, the God of heaven. And so he employs that title. But that in his mind, he's not talking about the God of heaven and earth. He's not talking about the one soul being over all things. The history suggests, and this is what's happening in 538. It's not just the Jews who are going back. All of the peoples of the ancient world that were deported from their lands and brought into Babylon, now under the king of Persia, are being allowed to return. They're all returning throughout the entire empire, from India all the way to Kush. They're all getting to go back. Israel the Israelites are just one people among the many. But he's speaking truth, a truth greater than he likely even knows. Chapter 2, 64 and 65. With Joshua the high priest, Zerubbabel the governor, Haggai and Zechariah the prophets, what do we have? The whole assembly together was 42,360 people, beside their male and female servants, of whom there were 7,337. And they also had 200 male and female singers. So these kinds of details are designed to heighten our awareness as readers that God was being faithful to preserve a remnant and giving us details that are going to be wrestled with and built upon in the first nine chapters of Chronicles. Because though Chronicles ends with Cyrus's decree, it's very clear that those who wrote the book of Chronicles are already part of the return back in Jerusalem. Because in the first nine chapters in the book of Chronicles, it testifies to the fact that those that were listed were among those who returned. Chapter 3, 2 and 3. Then arose Joshua, the son of Jozadak, with his fellow priests, and Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel with his kinsmen, and they built the altar of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings on it, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. These statements regarding the law of Moses, it seems to me, like in the book of Malachi, it is a return. This is an attempt at reformation, just like in the days of Josiah, just like in the days of Hezekiah, that what's going on here is these leaders are doing something to try to reawaken God-honoring Yahwism. This isn't about moral failure. This is about moral uprightness, that they're really seeking to align themselves with the law of Moses. So the first step in the temple reconstruction was the altar. Next, what do we read? The foundation of the temple is laid, verses 10 and 11. When the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, the priests in their vestments came forward with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals to praise Yahweh, according to the directions of David, the king of Israel. And they sang responsively, praising and giving thanks to Yahweh, for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever toward Israel. And all the people shouted with great shout when they praised Yahweh, because the foundation of the house of Yahweh was laid. So they arrive right in the city among all the rabble, the rubble, and the altar is built and the foundation of the temple is built, and it seems like things are moving along quickly. This is 538. I mean, they get there, it happens. And then for another 22 years, everything's going to stop. The temple is not going to be, well, it's at least 22 years before the temple is going to be finalized. It's like it's just going to be sitting there. We've all driven by such places where it's like, wonder what that was supposed to be. They ran out of money partway through. You drive throughout Ethiopia, the entire country is filled with buildings just like that. Half done, not completed. But finally, after we move, chapter 6, verses 14 and 15, we're going to move from Cyrus through Darius through Artaxerxes. So Cyrus, Darius, whom we're not exactly sure how he fits in the mix. There's Ahasuerus in there, and then there's Artaxerxes. So multiple generations of kings go by, and the decree of Cyrus set forth in the beginning that they could return and build the temple is not completed. It takes at least four kings before the decree is finished. And that's why we read in chapter 6, verse 14, "And the elders of the Jews built and prospered through the prophecy of Haggai and the prophet Zechariah, the son of Iddo. They finished their building, notice what it says, not by the decrees, plural, but by the decree, singular. The decree of the God of Israel, and by the decree of Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes. Now, in the story between chapters 1 and chapter 6, what we read is this intertension. Letters are sent. The Samaritans, and just who are the Samaritans? Well, they're the people who are living in the region of Samaria, which is where the northern kingdom of Israel's capital was. Assyria, though, deported all the elite or murdered them. So all that left in the land, we're told, was the poorest of the poor. And if there's no Jewish leadership or Israelite leadership in place, who's leading the area? Well, Assyria sent down governors and nobility down to this region. They had beautiful Mediterranean coastline. Many people would have been interested in that. Maybe they preferred the Mediterranean over the Persian Gulf. And they get to be here as foreign ambassadors in a land where they are top dogs. And what happens over time? These Assyrians begin to intermarry with the young Jewish women, and a new group of people is formed. It's a crossbreed group called the Samaritans. So what are the Samaritans? The Samaritans in Jesus' day are Jewish and Assyrian blend. And therefore, that's why the purebred Jews considered them outcasts. Well, it starts here. And it's these outcasts who have Assyrian blood and Jewish blood who are coming and wanting to stop the building of Jerusalem. Apparently because they probably were comfortable living under the guardianship of the Persian Empire. They didn't want to see Jerusalem rebuilt. We get details of what their concerns were in the letters that are sent from Sanballat and his regime up to the kings in Persia. And they're successful temporarily until in the final stage, the decree of Cyrus is found during the days of Artaxerxes the first. And in his days, it's recalled that a single decree has not been finalized. It's been delayed. And so finally, after these three kings gave decrees, it's all been the same decree. And why this is important, if you recall the Daniel notes, if you got that far or attempted to try to grasp my argument, is that when do we start counting 70 weeks of years, if we're indeed supposed to understand them literally? Well, it's supposed to happen from the going forth of the decree. So many people go all the way back to Cyrus, and chapter 6, verse 14 suggests to me the decree of Cyrus is actually not, it doesn't become effective for the building of the temple until all the way to the days of Artaxerxes the first. So that's when I start the time clock. Daniel was anticipating the end of 70 literal years. He's counting. And it seems to me that in some way we're supposed to understand an actual time clock with respect to the 70 weeks of years, that is 490 years. And if you pinpoint it from this date forward, you end up landing with the beginning of the 70th week happening right around AD 27, right around when Jesus' ministry would have began. And it would be the middle of that 70th week, sometime between the beginning and the end, that the three features of destroying the curse and the three features of initiating restoration blessing, including the ending of sacrifice and the establishment of righteousness and the overcoming of the curse, all of that would be associated then with the cross. Not in its final form, the 70th week, gets stretched out according to the book of Revelation, as I understand it, but it's inaugurated. And it's Jesus' death and resurrection that brings it about. And the timetable, intriguingly, lines up really well if you understand this to be a single decree. All right, next stage. Not only are we restoring the physical temple, this is a book about restoring the temple's faithless people. And that is the next stage. And here's where it becomes officially the memoirs of Ezra. So it's in this section that Ezra begins to talk in first person. Ezra 7, 9 and 10. On the first day of the first month, Ezra began to go up from Babylonia, and on the first day of the fifth month, he came to Jerusalem, for the good hand of his God was on him. 4. Why did he make it to Jerusalem? Because God's hand was on him. Why was God's hand on him? 4. Ezra set his heart to study and to practice the Torah of Yahweh and to teach both statute and rule in Israel. Study, practice, teach. This is not God's hand was on him because he was working hard for God and proving that he was faithful. It doesn't seem to me that that's the focus. Rather, God's hand was on him because he was dependent on God, a follower of his word, surrendered to the will of God, hungry to know what righteousness looks like in God's ways. And that's why the hand of God was upon him. He's not being portrayed here as an immoral priest, but rather as a moral priest who is surrendered to the King of Kings and wanting to be aligned with whatever Moses had to say. Here at the end of Old Testament history, you have someone embodied in the person of Ezra who is a man of the book. And he's going to try to seek to help the people live in accordance with the book. Notice the faith of Ezra that is testified to and the kindness of God in chapter 8, 21 and 22. Then I proclaimed, notice first person, I proclaimed a fast there at the river Ahava in Damascus, that we might humble ourselves before our God to seek from him safe journey for ourselves, our children, all of our goods. For I was ashamed to ask the king for a band of soldiers and horsemen to protect us against the enemy on our way, since we had told the king, the hand of our God is for good on all who seek him, and the power of his wrath is against all who forsake him. So there was a test put forward. Is Yahweh going to be faithful? And he didn't want to act as though he was questioning. I mean, I've got a dear friend, I think I've told you this, who says, He just says, I believe in the absolute sovereignty of God over all things. That's why I wear my seatbelt. So he doesn't want to presume on the sovereignty of God, and he recognizes that God's sovereignty uses means. It wouldn't have been wrong in my mind for him to say, God will keep me safe. I need an entourage. But he felt, it says, ashamed to tell the king. And so they're fasting and they're praying, and God is going to ultimately bring them in. All because, as it anticipated in chapter 7, he was seeking the Lord. Ezra arrives into town and he does not find anything good. He finds a people filled with debauchery who are running from the ways of the Lord. They're not humble. They're not pursuing uprightness. Instead, they've turned their back on their God. They're idolaters and they're syncretists. They're being pulled into the ways of the world. I don't think what is being denounced here is inter-tribal or inter-racial marriage. I think what's being denounced here, because it's grounded in the Torah, is interfaith marriage. That is always where the problem lies. Allowing two people of different faiths to come together, the testimony is It's not that the good apple will make the bad apple good, but rather the bad apple will consistently rotten the good apple. That you will not be able to stand strong easily married to a non-believer. The language is that non-believer will become a thorn in your side and lead you astray. Ezra has that in mind. He prays to God in chapter 9. If you just want to find your heart edified, take some weeks to read Daniel 9, Ezra 9, Nehemiah 9. Three great prayers of the Old Testament. Daniel 9, Ezra 9, Nehemiah 9. And just consider, what does prayer look like for these people who are truly seeking after the Lord? What did they pray? How did they think about history? How did they identify themselves with their people? What can I learn about prayer and about God from these texts? In Ezra 9, we read these words, 13 through 15. After all that has come upon us in exile, for our evil deeds and for our great guilt, seeing that you, our God, have punished us less than our iniquities deserved and have given us such a remnant as this, here we are, back in the land. Should we now break your commandments again and intermarry with the peoples who practice these abominations? That's the problem. Would you not be angry with us until you consumed us so that there should be no remnant nor any to escape? O Yahweh, the God of Israel, you are just, for we are left a remnant that has escaped as it is today. Behold, we are before you in our guilt, for none can stand before you because of this. There is great dilemma, great challenge. And so what happens after this prayer is Ezra leads the leaders to recovenant themselves before God, and the result is mass separation. That is mass divorce. Verse 11 of chapter 10. Now then, make confession to Yahweh, the God of your fathers, and do his will. It's very clear that's what he believes is going on here. Doing the will of God. And what is the will of God? Separate yourselves from the peoples of the land and from the foreign wives. What's at stake is because of these abominable practices, they are turning you. It seems to me likely he is seeing evidence already. This is what I think would give just grounds for divorce, is not the presence of being married to a non-believer. At least this is how I would understand it to align with Paul in 1 Corinthians 7. It's not the presence of being married to a non-believer, but when that non-believer is disallowing you from being the person that you need to be, or is infecting you in such a way that now you are not acting like a believer. And you're awakened. This is a type of desertion where the covenant partner is infecting rather than supporting the faith of the other. We end the book of Ezra with a whole list of guilty people. And then Nehemiah opens. It takes us back to Babylon or to Persia temporarily. An entourage shows up and tells Nehemiah, the remnant there in the province who had survived the exile is in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are destroyed by fire. Nehemiah prays, remember the word, O God, that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I'll scatter you among the peoples. This is Deuteronomy 28. But if you return to me, Deuteronomy 4, Deuteronomy 30, if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though your outcasts are in the uttermost parts of the heaven. From there I will gather them. From there I will bring them into the place that I have chosen to make my name dwell. That's Deuteronomy 30, 4 through 4 and 5. What's intriguing is he never mentions Deuteronomy 30, verse 6, circumcision of the heart. He stopped short of it. And we never see it operative in this book. What's at stake here is stage one, return to the land. And Cyrus's decree in the book of Isaiah was supposed to allow them to return to the land, Isaiah 45, and rebuild Jerusalem, rebuild its moats, rebuild its temple. But that Cyrus would be followed by another. And that's why, once again, somebody directed us to the Bible Project. And so I watched it again this just before class. And he goes to the book of Zechariah, which envisions that the new Jerusalem will be built without walls. And Nehemiah's point is to build Jerusalem with walls. And so the Bible Project guys said, well, that's a sign that they're not carrying out what they were supposed to do in restoration. I don't think that's the case, because I think Zechariah was actually envisioning the ultimate restoration associated with the Messiah. When he builds Jerusalem, it will be a Jerusalem without walls, meaning it'll be in perfect peace, with full protect, with no fear. But this is a Jerusalem filled with fear. It's designed to actually, it's not that they're not doing what they're supposed to do. No, it's that as they carry out what they're supposed to do, they're identifying this is not full fulfillment. They were never supposed to be the ones to bring it in. The Messiah is. But they are doing what they're supposed to do in stage one. Rebuild Jerusalem. That's what Isaiah said Cyrus would bring about. And that's what Nehemiah is carrying out. And yet all of it is in hope of something greater. And this whole book is designed to let us see what was promised has not been realized. All that's associated with restoration, including the servant himself, has not happened. Keep looking, keep longing, keep waiting, keep praying, keep persevering. He will come. And the kingdoms of man will be crushed, and the kingdom of God will be exalted on that day. Chapter 6, 15, the wall is finally built. So the wall was finished on the 25th day of the month of Elul in 52 days. But not only were they supposed to build the physical walls of Jerusalem in hope, they were to rebuild Jerusalem's faithless people. And that's where we come to the role of Ezra and this whole wrestling with interfaith marriage once again. So in fulfillment of Deuteronomy 31, every 7 years they were supposed to gather. Well, they haven't been doing that. That's the year of release. And they haven't been carrying it out. They haven't been, we're told, carrying out the year of Jubilee like they're supposed to. Seven sevens every 49th year. But on this day, gathered in Jerusalem, they're going to read the book of the law. That's what Deuteronomy 31 said. Every 7 years, gather all of Israel, men, women, children, and the sojourner who is within your gates. All of them are Israelites, some native born, some non-native born. Gather all the Israelites together and read the book of the law, that they might hear it in order that they might fear and obey. That is, that they might have an encounter with the living God through the word, that they might hear the word in a way that they can embrace, and it'll produce holiness in them, that they won't sin. That's what, from a revealed perspective, was supposed to be happening. Chapter 8, 8 and 10, they read from the book of the law clearly. They gave the sense so that the people understood the reading. This could mean that they read in Hebrew and then translated into Aramaic, the more common understanding of the people. Most of them would not have known Hebrew, most likely. Aramaic was the global language of the day. So Nehemiah was the governor, and Ezra the priest scribe, and the Levites who taught the people said to the people, "This day is holy to Yahweh your God. Do not mourn or weep." For all the people wept as they heard the words of the Lord. They knew how far they had come, how distant they were from what he wanted. "Don't weep. This day is a day of feasting. Eat, get fat, drink sweet wine. Send portions to anyone who has nothing ready, for this day is holy to our Lord. And do not be grieved, for the joy of Yahweh is your strength." The people under Nehemiah's lead then confess their sins. Here's Nehemiah chapter 9, 32 and 33. "For now, therefore, our God, the great, the mighty, and the awesome God, who keeps covenant and steadfast love," that's Deuteronomy 7, verse 9, "let not all the hardship seem little to you that has come upon us, upon our kings, our princes, our priests, our prophets, our fathers, and all your people, since the time of the kings of Assyria until this day." Notice the corporate solidarity. Those in exile are not just Judah. "Oh, we don't know where the 10 tribes are." No, they're here. "We are the people whom Assyria destroyed. We are the people whom Babylon conquered. We are the people since the days of Assyria that have known such punishment from you." They're viewing themselves as a collective whole. 12 tribes united. "In your great mercy, O God, you have been righteous in all that has come upon us. You have justly cursed us, for you have dealt faithfully. We have acted wickedly." So what does that wickedness look like? What does it mean? Look with me at 10, 28 through 32. "The rest of the people, the priests, the Levites, the gatekeepers, the singers, the temple servants, and all who separated themselves from the peoples of the lands to the law of God, their wives, their sons, their daughters, and all who have knowledge and understanding, all who turned through a mass divorce away from evil to cling to good, all of these people join with their brothers, their nobles, and enter into a curse, into an oath to walk in God's law that was given by Moses, the servant of God, to observe and do all the commandments of the Lord, our Lord, and his rules and his statutes." Well, what are the oaths that they make? Look first, verse 30. "We will not give our daughters to the peoples of the land to take their daughters for our sons." Deuteronomy 7, verse 4. Oath 2. "If the peoples of the land bring in goods or any grain on the Sabbath day to sell, we will not buy from them on the Sabbath or on a holy day. And we will forego the crops of the seventh year and the extraction of every debt. We will keep the Sabbath." 3. "We also take ourselves the obligation to give yearly a third part of the shekel for the service of the house of our God." So, 1, no interfaith marriage. 2, we will keep the Sabbath in all of its forms. 3, we will support the ministry of the temple. But now turn to chapter 13. And just look at how this is laid out. What does he find as he goes through as governor, overseeing the people? Verse 10, "I also found out that portions of the Levites that had not been given to them, so that the Levites and the singers who did the work had fled each to his field." The people were not giving the portions to support the ministry of the temple. They broke vow 3. Verse 15, "In the days I saw in Judah, people were treading wine presses on the Sabbath, bringing in heaps of grain and loading them on the donkeys, and also wine and grapes and figs and all kinds of loads, which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day in order to sell." They weren't keeping vow 2. Then, verse 23, "In those days I saw the Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab, and half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod, and they could not speak the language of Judah, but only the language of each people. I confronted them, I cursed them, I beat some of them, I pulled out their hair." Don't you remember that Moses said, "You shall not give your daughters to their sons and their daughters for your take their daughters for your sons"? Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin on account of such women?
Among the many nations, there was no king like him, and yet he was beloved by God, and God made him king over Israel. Nevertheless, the foreign women made him to sin. So it is that the book ends, "Remember me, O God, for good." I'm trying, God, I'm trying, but it's very, very evident that these people are not where they need to be. So just consider the flow. High point, Cyrus's decree to return. Low point, not very many want to return. High point, they lay the foundation of the temple. The temple is not quite what they had hoped for, and so it tells us that there's weeping mixed with joy. They stop building the temple in chapter 4. High point, they finish the temple. The decree for Ezra to return is made. There's fasting and prayer for safety. God honors them and preserves them. He arrives in low point. There's interfaith marriage. There's need for mass divorce and cleansing. Nehemiah prays and pleads for the rebuilding and the reviving of Jerusalem. The exhortation to rebuild is met with challenge. There's continual opposition from outside, enemies not wanting them to rebuild. There's confrontation of opposition from within because there's oppression being done to the poor. Finally, the wall is completed, but the priests are unable to find proof of their genealogy in order to establish their ministry. They celebrate the sabbatical year and they worship it and they renew the covenant. The wall is dedicated, and yet the book ends with them having to confront more moral degradation. This is a book of tension. This is restoration. This is what we were hoping for. Where is all that we longed? In your great mercies, you didn't make an end of them or forsake them. For you are a gracious and a merciful God. Oh, Lord, please preserve. That's the sense. You're coming to the very end of the Old Testament, and you're learning that it's coming to the end, and it demands the sequel. It demands more, because the restoration of Cyrus was not it. They don't have circumcised hearts. Jerusalem has walls rather than no walls. There's no sign that God's glory has returned. I can comment on that further. It isn't, the Messiah hasn't come, and therefore the nations aren't joining. They're not surrendering to Yahweh. They're wanting to bring their paganism in. And it's infecting and affecting all that the Israelites are. They're still in slavery, as testified to by both Ezra and Nehemiah. And there's no Messiah in their midst. This is the final step in Old Testament history. The book of Chronicles is actually going to go backwards. And it's not going to make it this far. It's going to come about to the decree of Cyrus and leave us hanging, as we're going to see. And there's a reason why it does. But today, this is what we get. Despite God returning his people to the land and enabling them to successfully rebuild Jerusalem's temple and surrounding walls, Israel remains in slavery. Israel remains failing to faithfully obey the terms of the covenant. And thus they show their need for the transforming work of the Messiah after the exile is over. It's the Messiah who will end the curse. They're still living under the curse. That's how I understand Ezra, Nehemiah. Two brothers longing to see transformation and serving a people that was as hard-hearted as the Israel of Moses' day. You come to the end of the Old Testament and very little has changed in the storyline. They've even gotten to return to the land, and yet, as many people have said, they could leave Babylon, but they couldn't get Babylon out of themselves. So it feels low. And it's into this lowness then that we get this restart. It's going to restart us by taking us all the way back to Adam, who's the very first word of the book of Chronicles. a people living in desperation. Remember me, O God, for good. Remember me, O God. Remember me, O God. That level of, is there any hope? Is there any help? Do you remember Adam? I had a purpose way back then. And the book of Chronicles is going to treat from Adam all the way up to Dave as if everything was a prelude to get us to David. The genealogies are going to take us from Adam all the way up to David. It's going to hop over the narrative of Saul in 15 verses and get us right into the heart of David. It's not going to focus on the northern kingdom. It's going to focus on the south, on Judah, on the hopeful part of the history in order to heighten hope in the coming Messiah.
Thank you for listening to this message from Dr. Jason DeRoshi. Feel free to make copies of this message to give to others, but please do not charge for these copies or alter their content in any way without written permission from Dr. Jason DeRoshi. For more writings, sermons, and lectures from Dr. DeRoshi, please visit www.jasonderoshi.com. Proclaiming the kingdom and treasuring the God who reigns, saves, and satisfies through covenant for his glory in Christ.